NFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Oregon State is telling me if we want Jaden Robinson, we can have Jaden Robinson all year. He wants to do it. This question brought to you by Jamba. Life is better blended. Because Jamba sponsors that weekly segment where we interview an Oregon State athlete or an Oregon athlete. And so Jaden Robinson potentially making the Oregon State appearance. Tweet at me, at John Canzano BFT. Tell me if you support Jaden Robinson as the athlete who should participate in our weekly interview brought to you by Jamba.
Well, that was the question we should have asked him is, what's your Jamba flavor? What's your go-to?
I'm going to text him right now. I'm going to ask him, what is your go-to Jamba?
And that might decide the answer. You know, if it's a good answer.
Yeah.
That's plus points.
Oh, let's see what he says. Coming up later this hour, Kelly Graves. You'll hear my interview with Graves, University of Oregon women's basketball coach. He's in Paris. I don't know why I see him with one of those French hats on and a striped shirt, and he's eating a croissant or a croissant if you're not in Paris. We'll find out more about Kelly Graves' journey to France coming up, and you'll hear him from Paris. It's kind of nice to know somebody who's there, you know? So technology today, very easy for him. I texted with him. He said, I'd love to come on. I said, great, let's do this. By the way, what time is it when we, like 4 o'clock, 4:20, what time would it be in Paris around that hour? And of course, for people who know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. It's 1:02 in the morning now in Paris. So they're just getting going. They're just getting going in France. But I said to Kelly Graves, why don't we tape this around like 1 p.m., which is 10 p.m. their time. So we taped the interview right before the show. And then I wrote a column about Teresa Gold, the Pac-12 commissioner. And then I went right into the show. So it's been a lively Friday afternoon. I thought it would be a relatively slow Friday afternoon, but it's been very lively. And we'll see how that goes. I got a question, too, that came up in our household. Are you a soccer guy, Stephen, at all?
I would say no.
Okay, I'm not really a soccer guy.
I would say not really, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched soccer. I've been to soccer matches. I've been to Timber matches. I've been to Olympic soccer matches.
I think is cool. Like, like the FIBA or the World, the Copa FIFA? America. Sorry, yeah, Copa America was on. Like, those are fun. The World Cups are fun, but outside of that, fine.
So today, a interesting question came up in our household because our youngest daughter has played more soccer than anybody in the family. Any of the other two sisters. Youngest daughter likes the game. She has fun. She's decent at it. She wants to play. So she's playing on this team that is having a big tournament this weekend. Bunch of kids are playing soccer. And she went to go get her jersey, and came time for her to pick a number. And soccer numbers, historically, there's a history behind the soccer numbers, but there's a little bit... Soccer numbers are a little, I don't want to say persnickety, but the number one usually goes to a goalie because you have to have a goalkeeper, and it's the first person that's listed on the lineup card. So goalkeepers have traditionally wore the number one. Your attacking players traditionally wear numbers 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. Lionel Messi wears 10. For example, there are exceptions to this, but those numbers, much like in basketball, 23, Michael Jordan, later LeBron, became a coveted number. 8, Kobe, became a coveted number. What else in basketball? Coveted numbers. 32, Magic.
Yeah, Magic. It's Jordan, it's Kobe now, and then, so yeah, it's 23, 24, kind of the go-tos right now.
There you go. And LeBron, does LeBron not get credit for wearing 23 or what?
I mean, kind of, but I think it's mostly MJ, right?
You're such a hater. but in soccer, there's a little bit, like, when you're playing upper levels of soccer, the jersey numbers, you'll tend to notice, like, number 9 becomes like a, you know, your center midfielder, it's a striker number, you know, that's a scorer. But my kid is, she's like a forward, but she wanted the number 1. And I have always traditionally looked at the number 1 and thought, you know, it takes a lot of confidence to wear the number 1. But she wanted to wear the number 1, and I was like, I don't know, is that supposed to be the goalie on your team? Like, isn't, you know? So I was kind of thinking about that, and I reached out to John Strong, the voice of American soccer. And I said, hey, if she takes the number 1, is that supposed to go to the goalie or whatever? And he's like, she's 8. Unless the coach has come up in 1950s Germany, they can wear any number. And so I would have went for like a 42 or a 99, something different. But she's out there running around today as the number 1 on her team. And it so happens, I told her this too, that her picture and her number are the same. She's very skinny, and so she's a number 1, and she looks like a number 1 when she's out there. So there she is. Did you know that about soccer numbers, that the goalkeeper, like if you look at the U.S. women's national team in the Olympics right now, the goalkeeper on the women's team wears number 1.
I can't say that I would know that, but I would have probably guessed it because, I mean, it is for basketball and for baseball and for football. They all kind of have their own designated alleys.
I didn't know that, though. I didn't know that until I looked it up. I had to look it up.
But if you had to guess, would you have guessed that? Because, like, in baseball, I mean, 18 is first base.
I wouldn't have. But then, you know what I found out when I started going down the rabbit hole is, you know, when you think about baseball numbers, some of the great baseball numbers of all time, historically, you think about this. Babe Ruth wore the number 3. He was the 3 hitter for the Yankees. It was the number 3 was by his name in the lineup. And so Babe Ruth wore 3. Lou Gehrig wore 4. That's why they wore the number 3 and the number 4. And I didn't really realize that either until I started researching, the lineup and the numbers. And it was interesting to me to kind of see, like, oh yeah, like the Yankees lineup that featured Ruth and Gehrig, you basically had Ruth wearing 3 and you had Gehrig wearing 4.
Well, when you played, was the number super important to you?
It was. I was a big, like, I liked Jackie Robinson and I liked Ted Williams. And so if I was on a team where I could get any number, I would always, whether it was football or baseball or whatever, I would try to get 42. And then if I couldn't, I would try to get 9 for Ted Williams, because that was the other number. And 9 wasn't like a real popular number. People wanted 8. People wanted 1. People wanted 2, 6, you know, but I don't know. Was number big for you in basketball? What'd you wear?
It was not a big one for me. I always wanted to be 50 because I always thought it was cool, like when a guard would wear 50. I can only think of one. That was Eddie House back in the day. He used to wear number 50. I always thought it looked really cool. And I mean, I just wanted to be different. Like you said, nobody's 50 and out there. But I was numerous different numbers. High school, I want to say I was like 32. And then in college, I was like 10 and 12 and 34 at the same time in my 4 years. Yeah. So numbers not a big deal for me.
There you go. Well, there we have it. Let's play some Punch It.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Hey, Thamel. ESPN. Talking about the playoff. How will the playoff affect the regular season? How will it affect teams? Thamel trying to put a finger on it. Punch it.
And this is part of the gift that we don't know what's in and we don't know what's unwrapped is, like, when do you stop being a contender when you don't really have any, like, knowledge of how the playoff is going to unfold? And I think, too, the league's growing the way they are. We have no idea how the committee is going to judge these teams, right? This many lost SEC team versus this many lost Big 12. So I feel like until November 1st, and I'm just absolutely making this up off the top of my head, there will be 30 teams, you could say, that are in contention.
I think it's too many. I think he's casting too broad a net for November 1st. But I think there will be maybe 20 that are in contention at that point, including the group of fives, which will have a couple of teams that aren't ranked in there. But I think it's going to come down to, like, the top 15 or 18 teams really thinking they're jockeying for position. Couple on the outside looking in. I think 30 is too many. Steven, you?
Yeah, I think 30 is too many. I also think that as time goes by, we're going to figure out that the number 11 seed or the number 10 seed isn't necessarily a true contender, right? Like, they'll get into the playoffs, so technically they have a chance to win the national title. But I do think when we get to the top four, top five teams, it's going to be a different tier than 6 through 10 in a lot of years. So I think there's going to be a lot of times where, yeah, a team gets in at number 10 or 11, but they're not really true contenders. Maybe they get an upset. Maybe they can upset one of these top teams. But I think when we get closer to it, the list will dwindle down to, you know, 15, 20 teams, and we'll figure out who's really fighting. You know, we're going to argue 13 and 14. We're not going to be fighting over who number 20 is.
We're also going to be faced with the group of five champion. Is it a ranked team? Can it be anything other than the 12 seed? You're going to have to be ranked above 12 in the CFP rankings to get in there. But I'm really curious to see how that plays out. I also am interested in how many teams the Big Ten and how many teams the SEC are going to get in the first year, 12-team playoff. Will they get three? Will someone get four? Keep an eye on that. Lincoln Riley at USC. USC officially a member of the Big Ten Conference as of midnight. Lincoln Riley talking about the dawn of an era. Punch it.
Well, it's a massive change. It is. I think we'll all understand, like, how big of a change it is as time goes on, because, you know, college football, as we all know, has changed in so many ways. But when this big of a combination, you take a team that has historically played the majority of their games, you know, out west, and now all of a sudden you're going to bring in all of these different matchups. You're going to have different rivalries that grow because of this. You know, the history is going to be changed forever, and you'll look back and say this was the day that it all started.
Is this the day that it all started, though? I mean, really? I mean, I think if you really start to go back, you start to unwind it, you start to find that this kind of the mechanisms were in place and were slowly moving 5-6 years ago. Pat Chun at Washington tried to summarize why this is important for his school, Huskies, in the Big Ten. Punch it.
Well, it's a momentous day, and it's a day that you know, when you think about where college athletics is at, where the Big Ten is relative to prominence, not only as a college entity but as a global brand, and where Washington is in terms of an institution and a global brand. It's you know, we're honored to be a part of the Big Ten Conference. We're excited about what's on the horizon, but also excited just to be, I've told a lot of people when you walk around our campus and you get the sense of what Washington is, you know, the type of institution we are. I mean, we are a Big Ten school, and you know, this is where we're supposed to be, and it's where we feel like we can impact our young people the best by putting them on the biggest stage possible, and that's the Big Ten Conference.
It's so weird to hear Chun talking like that after he was talking very differently at Washington State about what happened to the Pac-12. I think he's saying what he needs to say, and he's speaking largely to his own constituents, and that's what people do. Still, it's kind of weird. Dana Altman at Oregon, they're in the Big Ten in men's basketball. What's that going to be like? Punch it.
Well, first of all, you know, for basketball, great venues, great coaches. You know, you look around and a lot of those guys have been at those institutions a long time and have had a great deal of success. So competition will be great. The environments will be great.
I'm not convinced that it's going to be a tougher conference for him. He won't have Arizona to deal with. He won't have UCLA to deal with. There's still challenges in the Big Ten. Certainly Purdue was fantastic a year ago.
But when you say the environments are going to be tougher, like the road games are going to be, like when you go to Illinois, that is a tough game. When you go to, you know, a Washington who has had some good teams, it's not necessarily a super tough game.
No.
Environment-wise.
Yeah, but there were some bad environments in the Pac-12 that weren't necessarily tough places to play and win. And not every place in the Big Ten is tough, Stephen. I've covered that conference. You can go to Northwestern. You can go to Minnesota. You go play at Rutgers.
Rutgers has historically had a tough basketball environment. And they got the number one recruit coming in.
We'll see. I only speak for Iowa, Illinois, Purdue, Indiana. Those are tough places to play.
Do you think Oregon can get to the NCAA tournament next season?
Yes. But I think it has more to do with the fact that they've got a really good guard in Jackson Shellstead who's going to carry him there. I don't care where they're playing. I think he's that good. And, I don't love some of what's going on with Oregon's roster. I'm trying to figure out, how do they replace Nfali Dante? And, are the kids that Dana Altman's going to bring in going to be team guys? But Jackson Shellstead is so good, he's above that. I think he carries them there regardless. Let's talk about Bo Nix. Diana Russini of The Athletic saying that Bo Nix is checking all the boxes in Denver's preseason camp. Punch it.
Bo Nix has had a really good camp so far. The difficulty from going from playing college, you know better than anyone, to going to the NFL, it's a substantial step that you need to take. But the fact that he is able to get in and out of the huddle without any issues. Yeah. The offensive line isn't getting called for penalties. Things that we heard so much of last year, but I'm hearing out of Denver, this stuff is already getting cleaned up with a rookie quarterback. In terms of what Bo Nix has shown them there, they know that they've got something that they can build off.
Well, Bo Nix is like 30 years old. That's part of this, right? He started 60 games in college. He's got some experience. He's seen some stuff. He can get you in and out of the huddle. This is not, this isn't a rookie like rookies used to be in the NFL. Because things that rookies used to be in the NFL were rookies were younger and less experienced. And what do we say? We always said, it takes them 2 or 3 years. They need more reps. But I would argue that it's the same logic that the 49ers benefited from. Brock Purdy, Iowa State. Steven, he started 48 games in college. So when Brock Purdy was thrown in there, this wasn't his, first situation. Sure, it was the NFL. Yes, it moved faster. Yes, it was a different offense. But he came in after sitting behind Jimmy Garoppolo and after having 48 starts in college and staying in college for 5 years. Bo Nix had longer than that at Oregon, 60-plus starts, NCAA record, 61 starts,
but
multiple schools. It's a huge advantage.
It is, but should we be super excited that he's just getting the team in and out of huddles without getting penalties? I don't know. Is he making good throws down the field? Is he making good decisions on the field? All the stuff I hear about Bo Nix is how good he is off the field, and we knew that's how it would be. The guy works hard. The guy has a great memory. He's one of the smartest guys in the game. But sometimes that only gets you so far, especially in the NFL or at the top levels. He has to prove he can do it with his arm, with his legs, with his brain during the play. Great, you can get the guys in and out of huddle. They're not doing false starts. Awesome. Can you make a throw on 3rd and 8 up in Seattle week 1 with a guy in your face? That's what I need to see.
Yes, but it's the kind of stuff that reporters watching a couple of days of training camp are being told, right? And they're saying, he's getting us in and out of the huddle. It's not a big deal. But I think it's basically they're just saying he has command, he's confident, he's got some poise. He's acting like a veteran, like he knows what he's doing. And I think that is some valuable stuff. Canada's 3-0 in the Olympics in basketball. Brian Windhorst says, do not sleep on Canada. It's not a hockey town anymore. Punch it.
Well, they play a game that really matches the way the Team USA plays. They can play small. They have wing defenders, which is what you need against Team USA. They can switch 1 through 5. They obviously are not going to have any fear about going up against the Americans, who they are, their peers.
What do you think about Canada? Not a hockey town, not a hockey country, Is Canada a basketball country, Stephen?
They are. I have a bet on Canada to win the gold medal already. I bet that before it. I think that they're the second best team in the world behind the USA. I think
what
USA.
What do you like about them? What do you like about Canada?
Their guard play is elite. They have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and then they also have guys that get out and guard. Dylan Brooks, Lou Dort, RJ Barrett. Like, those guys that get out in the NBA and can guard those players. The problem they have, though, is they don't have great bigs, and USA, if they are struggling, which I think they will, Canada's going to be an elite defensive team, they can get them on the offensive rebounds. And that's where Canada struggles, is when they face big guys that can rebound. The game against Spain today, Spain was pushing them around. So that's the one weakness they have. But I think if you're going to go up and they're going to challenge them, you know Dylan Brooks is going to get in people's face. That makes me believe that America's going to say, okay, we're going to play some hero ball. We're going to go one-on-one ISO, and that's exactly what Canada's going to want you to do. They want to go one-on-one with you, offense versus their elite defense. I think that's the way they can get them. I hope that's the gold medal game. It'll be a great game between those two. I think USA should win, but the value in Canada was like 10-1, something like that. I think that was too much. I think Canada's actually a really good team, and I think they are going to win the gold medal.
There's an issue that Steve Kerr is having, and that he's being criticized for his starting lineups. He has mostly started Steph Curry, LeBron, Joel Embiid, Devin Booker, Drew Holiday. But he has featured lineups that had Jason Tatum, Anthony Edwards as starters. LeBron alongside Devin Booker one day, alongside Jason Tatum and Anthony Edwards another day. Anthony Davis had a start. Do egos get in the way at some point, or are these guys willing to be like the redeem team in 2008 that came back with a vengeance, with really Kobe leading the way, saying we need to put all of this behind us? I don't know if they have that guy like Kobe who's going to rally everybody together and be like, hey, it doesn't matter who's starting. We need to play. What do you think?
No, I agree with you, and I think that's what Canada has. Canada has Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Like, that is their guy, and he's the leader that everyone else follows. My fear with USA is when it comes down to the end of the game in a close game, it's going to be straight ISO ball. It's going to give me the ball, get out of my way, whether that's LeBron or Jason Tatum or Anthony Edwards. And we've seen in the past that doesn't work. Like, the world is too good now to just say, okay, here's our best versus your best. We're going to beat you one-on-one. It has to be a team game, and we've seen when USA is playing really well, they're moving the ball around. They're playing together as a team. I think that this type of team that they have right now for America is going to fall into the isolation trap. And that's where I worry them against Canada. So, yeah, you're right. Unless they get out to a big lead and it doesn't matter, if it's a close game at the end of the game, I think that's where USA may struggle, actually.
I think you are onto something there that is worth talking about. Also worth talking about, the new kickoff rule in the NFL was on full display last night. First exhibition preseason game of the year. Looked very weird. Jason Kelce talking about it.
This play has been made obsolete in the past few years.
It became basically a mindless exercise.
It was a ceremony. Oh, here's the opening kickoff ceremony, rundown, 60 yards for no reason.
Commercial.
And now all of a sudden it's going to mean something. The game is better when special teams play a factor, when it makes a difference. And all those guys that put in that hard work get to go out there and actually execute something.
New kickoff rules. It makes the kickoff more relevant, but Steven, I am watching like video of this overhauled kickoff. It looks like the XFL to me.
It's weird. It is weird for sure. I don't know that I like the look of it. I think we'll get used to it as time goes on. But to that point, Jason Kelce's point, there was only one touchback last night. There was a lot of actual action on the kickoff, and I do think that there could be a chance that special team coordinators aren't necessarily throwing out their haymakers in the preseason, right?
True.
Like, they may be drawing something up ready for the regular season. We may see, some type of play out of this. Maybe, at the end of games, if teams are down by 6 points or 3 points, they need to get good field position. Maybe they throw a Justin Jefferson back there or a Tyreek Hill. And when they usually don't return kicks, I think this has potential to be really good. But you're right. It looked really weird, really clunky in the first game. But again, Hall of Fame game, can only take the one game sample size. But I think eventually we'll end up liking this rule.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. We'll see. It's going to result in fewer injuries, but obviously new strategy will come from it. But I looked at it and I was like, I have not seen this before. This looks like me and the two youngest daughters lining up the electric football players in a weird formation.
Yeah, it's like us playing in the backyard or something. Yes. Like, hey, you know what? We'll line up here and try to get by.
No,
me.
This doesn't work. Where's the why isn't everybody lined up in a line running full blast towards each other? All right, you're going to hear my interview with Kelly Graves. He's in Paris. He was in a good mood. Oregon women's basketball coach talked about recruiting from another country and more. Leave it here.